Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. 30 billion photos are posted on Facebook every day. Data storage centers have grown to meet the demand, and the New Albany area has become a hub for them. The first phase of Facebook's operation went online last week, and that represents a $1 billion investment alone. Dispatch reporter Mark Williams toured Facebook's facility last week. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not the kind of thing that you think of as being a big deal.
How big are these things?
Well, so one of the kickers for Facebook's announcement on Thursday was that they were going to add two more buildings to already what they've got started or now working. So that'll give them five buildings, each one 500,000 square feet.
Is it bigger than a football field?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was impressive. So we're taking a little tour of the place, and you're standing somewhere in the middle, and you can look all the way down to one end, and you look all the way down to the other end, and it's just like you can barely see the end of the room.
The horizon.
The horizon.
The earth is curving at the end.
Yeah, exactly. It's an incredible sight. They actually wanted to take us up to the roof, but it was, if you recall, it was kind of drizzly and icy that day. It was deemed a little hazardous for our health. But these things are just massive.
And what's inside of them?
Just little machines that I would technically, technically they're servers. You get in the technical part. I don't do very well.
Yeah, me either.
But they're just, they've got multiple, framing of that holds multiple servers. Each server's, like about a foot long, about a foot wide, and they just hold all this data, and it's really interesting. The whole thing's completely automated, so that if something goes wrong, it sends a signal to where all the staff is, and then the staff can go and come and check it out, and they can make the fixes within a couple minutes don't even need a tool to replace the server. That's if a server's gone bad, just plop it out with their fingers and plop a new one in. It takes just a couple of minutes. In fact, it probably takes longer to walk to where the server is that needs to be fixed than the actual repair.
So not a lot of jobs.
No, they're not. I think in this case, Facebook's talking about 150 jobs by the time they'll be done with all that.
All five
now,
of them?
The good news, these are really well-paying jobs. I mean, these are jobs that I think $80,000, $100,000 a year, so they do pay well.
But they take up a lot of space.
They take up a lot of space.
And that's the problem, right?
I don't know if it's a problem. They just take up a lot of space. I mean, they're, in the case of
New Albany. But we're only just starting this journey of data storage.
Yes.
Relatively speaking.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean.
Well, this thing has exploded in the last few years.
Yeah.
I mean, I never even wrote about this stuff until Amazon got approval for its data centers. I think it was in 14 or 15. And so that's where the real kick to this whole movement started. So once Amazon started putting data centers here, then we had Facebook's announcement a couple years ago. Now Google has started one.
Why is that? Why do they? Birds of a feather?
Birds of a feather. That's part of it. The other part of it is the state has made an effort to do this. I mean, there are big tax incentives. Every one of these companies gets millions and millions of dollars for putting those data centers there in forms of incentives, tax incentives.
These are the wealthiest companies in the world.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's an argument that you could make.
Yeah, yeah. So they're getting tax incentives, but they're not really bringing that many jobs.
Not really. Well, and other than during the construction phase.
Construction, thousands of jobs then. Yeah.
So you have to have kind of the ideal circumstances for these things. And Ohio tends to have them, which is that you got to have access to lots of electricity. You've got to be sort of immune from natural disaster. No hurricanes.
Yeah, we're pretty lucky on that score.
No hurricanes, really no earthquakes.
We don't even have winter anymore.
No, we don't have winter anymore. Tornadoes can be a problem, but it's got to be a doozy. So you throw that in there. You got a workforce that can take care of these things, you got to have kind of set up for it. And so AEP has worked with the New Albany to make sure that they're set up to have. They have the ample supplies of electricity because they do use a ton of electricity.
Mm-hmm. Do they Are the regions that these data servers or data centers serve, I mean, is it regionalized? So there are other hubs like this around the country?
Yeah. Well, even around the world in case of Facebook.
Yeah.
I think that this is like the 14th data center that they've got. And I know that there's been some other locations too. I think there is some notion of having sort of geographically spread out a little bit as best you can it creates redundancy in the system to make sure everything's protected, because God knows when you might want to see that cat video again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is very important stuff. How long do these things take to build? They take years to build.
They can take a couple years to build. Yeah. I mean, I think the announcement that we had for Facebook was 2017, I want to say. So now you're just getting the first one up and running.
How long does it take to fill up one of these centers with data?
Oh, I don't know that. I mean, I would assume that there is, in the case of Facebook, obviously you're looking at, you know, growing users between Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and all that. There's a lot of stuff going on. I do not know that in terms of how long that takes. I would assume that they're just preparing for the continuing onslaught of data.
Is it pretty high security?
I thought it was, but then I would think that you have. In fact, I don't even recall seeing the name Facebook on the outside of the building.
Interesting.
So,
What about the residents? Like I said, these are just huge, big buildings. Mm-hmm. They're bigger than football stadiums, which is, you know, an easy way to describe things in this city. But what do people feel about living around these things?
Is
it way out in the country?
Yeah, it's out. I mean, it's in an industrial park. Uh-huh. So it's not, I mean, it's, this is kind of what it's built.
It was never going to be pretty.
Yeah, it's built for this kind of stuff. You know, whether it's that or something else. A distribution center. I mean, it could just be kind of a, you know, it kind of looks from the outside, it sort of looks like a distribution center. So we've got a zillion of those around here as well. So this is the kind of thing I think most people would be excited about if you lived in that town, only from the sense of, hey, you know, tech company has got data center here. Google's got a data center or building data center here. Amazon has data centers.
Is it necessarily a prelude to anything more complicated, though? Anything more of a presence than just the data centers?
Well, that's always the good question. That's what happened with Amazon. I mean, Amazon started with the data centers. Then we got the distribution centers after that. And then the other things started to come in. And so I think there's always some feeling that once you establish a foothold, that could lead to something else. I think that's certainly what people from an economic development perspective have, having their fingers crossed that something else could come from that.
Tell me more about the incentives that the state's given.
The state has made this a priority, and so these things cost a lot to build. It's been several years now since they've done them and they've really wanted to make sure that they created an environment where these things could come along. And I know that I know I've written about some of this in terms of the incentives in the past, but I think in the case of like Facebook, I mean, these are tens of millions of dollars in total.
Uh-huh.
And I think, let's see if I remember this correctly. Yeah, for Facebook, it was $43.5 million. And these are breaks typically like on sales tax and that kind of thing. And it's based on the size of the investment. So the bigger the investment, the more you'll get. I think Google's actually might even been a bigger one. Of course, that $43.5 million could actually end up being low, given that they've since added to the project.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say that Amazon's was somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million when they announced theirs.
Is the idea that the state subsidizes or gives incentives for these things not because they're bringing a lot of jobs, but they bring the potential that they're creating these footholds? What's the
But it's any kind of technology that, you know, that's identified as an important economic driver. If you get this, can you get something else? Can you build a reputation as a place where those kinds of things can be located?
Uh-huh.
And then you can just the theory of it is you do that, leads to another, mm-hmm. just keeps on going down the road.
But it didn't lead to the big Amazon investment that the state was hoping for.
Well, they did get the distribution center.
They got the distribution center, but not the big second headquarters.
Not second headquarters. But, well, that was, I mean, they started developing these well before the second headquarters came along.
Right. And it doesn't lead to necessarily something like that.
No. I mean, it just, I mean, that for Amazon, that's over $1 billion investment in their data centers here. So that is a substantial investment. From an economic development perspective, that's bigger than most of the projects I write about.
Okay. And what's next? What's on the horizon? You mentioned the other big buildings for Facebook, more data centers there, but other companies? Has the state talked about that?
Not with the name of those. Those would be the ones that I think people would talk about the most. There's certainly other data centers. You have to keep in mind that the this explosion of data is just not occurring with Facebook. It's occurring with all kinds of companies that want these data centers to be able to store all their data too. Just that these are not names that are as well known as those.
So the big names are what will attract the smaller ones.
Right.
How many centers like this are there in the country?
I don't know how many in the country have, but we have over 100 in Ohio.
Huh.
And the weirdest one, in my mind, maybe it's not weird, but I think it's weird. I think it's interesting.
Yeah.
There's being one developed in Monroe County, which is way over in eastern Ohio, right along the
border,
right along the line.
Indiana. Yeah.
So if you recall from a while ago, there used to be an aluminum smelter there called Ormet. That operated there, and it shut down some number of years ago. The site has been converted into kind of an industrial park, and there is a company that is wanting to develop a data center on that facility. And I can't recall the name of the company.
Isn't that like Tornado Alley over there?
I don't think right there.
Okay.
It's got access. They're also on that site building a natural gas fired power plant. So the electricity will be right there close by. And so, that particular one will, I believe, store some important federal government data.
Okay.
So it kind of needs to be more isolated and where it can be, I think, safer.
As far as the energy consumption goes, if we have a blackout, if something goes wrong, what happens to those places?
Well, there's always redundancies in the system. So if there's a problem there, they'll have it. They'll have the same information elsewhere as well. These things do take a ton of electricity. And there's been some issue. I mean, it requires a lot of electricity to run, and so you've got to make sure that you have adequate supplies to make sure that continues to be operational.
Were there investments made by state or local government to provide that?
Yeah, well, they struck deals with AEP. In fact, I think Amazon hit one with AEP some number of years ago that I don't even know that information even became public in terms of how much they're spending for electricity.
But they cut a deal.
I mean, but this is very typical. I mean, in the past, industrial users of electricity
they don't pay residential rates.
Yeah, they don't pay residential rates because they're using so much.
Right. Well, Mark Williams, thanks for joining us to talk about this. I appreciate it.
Happy to.
Mark Williams is a business reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We've been talking about data storage centers and how they're growing to meet the demand and how New Albany area has become a hub for them. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The Justice Department this week announced charges against four members of China's military on suspicion of hacking into one of the nation's largest credit reporting agencies in 2017. Attorney General William Barr called the hack deliberate and sweeping, and the indictment suggests the exploit was part of a series of big data thefts organized by the People's Liberation Army and Chinese intelligence agencies. Most likely, the hackers are looking for personal information to use against American intelligence officers and other officials in bribery or blackmail schemes. The 2017 hack wasn't the largest known breach, but given the amount and type of personal data stolen, it was among the most damaging. New York Times reporter Katie Benner covers the Justice Department. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what do the indictments allege these guys did?
So the indictments allege that these four PLA officers in China broke into the Equifax database, that they monitored the system, and that they were able to exfiltrate a lot of information about customers, nearly half of all Americans, and then a couple of million Canadians and UK citizens as well.
What they think they're looking for. How do they know what to look for?
Well, so it's interesting. This is what we're starting to think of as a big data hack, where you're just sweeping in tremendous amounts of raw data on as many people as possible. And there's a near-term reason that China would want to do that and a future-term reason they'd want to do that. In the near term, they can look and see who might have financial issues. They can see personal information like social security numbers that allows you to go further into somebody's life and maybe hack into other of their accounts. And especially for people who work for the government, this is information that can make you vulnerable today to, you know, Chinese grooming, you know, Chinese coercion into getting you to do something that would hurt your company or hurt your government. So that is the near-term reason they might want to do this. And they've already hacked information from Starwood. They've hacked information from the, you know, a government database full of personnel information. So they can use those bits of data, lay them over one another, and say, we have a pretty full picture of somebody's life who works for the government. In the future term, for your listeners who are tech listeners, they understand that for artificial intelligence to understand human behavior, where a person's going, what they might do in the future to make these predictive models, you just need vast amounts of data. Looking at what people do over time, what hotels they've stayed in, what they've spent money on, when they take risk, what they've done in their lives, especially around their financial lives, is really important to make these predictive models that will allow China to have dominance over other countries, including the United States, around human behavior prediction, and then, of course, help them as they decide, you know, who to target in the future in terms of espionage and other sorts of intelligence gathering.
It's sort of a macro and a micro, right?
Absolutely.
The Justice Department rarely indicts members of foreign militaries or intelligence services, and I'm wondering, what are they going to get out of this indictment? I mean, they're not going to get these guys, are they?
Right, and so I think first, to go to your point that the Justice Department rarely decides to indict foreign militaries or intelligence services.
Uh-huh.
You know, that is in part because we make exceptions for those activities. They're not covered in the criminal code because all countries engage in some form of espionage. That mm-hmm. is a different realm. But one of the reasons why the Justice Department in this case made an exception is because they are saying what's happening now is, one, it's a crime. You're stealing company secrets. You're stealing from the corporation. And also, they feel like the severity of this is such that the indictment sends a message to China, we're going to publicly call you out on this. We're going to publicly reveal that we know what you're doing because it needs to stop. Again, because all countries are engaged in espionage, we don't usually call out people for what we would think of as the normal course of business of intelligence gathering, just like people do not call out the United States. But this, for the government, for the U.S. government, went beyond the pale.
And how does China respond?
So for now, China hasn't responded. What is interesting is that in 2015, President Barack Obama and President Xi Jinping, they agreed to rein in economically motivated cyber attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So cyber attacks that would give companies access to intellectual property. They decided they weren't going to attack critical infrastructure. But that sort of exposed an interesting, huge difference in U.S. versus sort of Chinese thinking. For us, we think of military, corporation, and intelligence as sort of three different realms.
Mm-hmm.
In China, they think of it as all the same. And so another thing that Justice Department officials argued was, while this did not violate the letter of that 2015 agreement. It violates the spirit of it because for China, this sort of espionage, this sort of intelligence gathering, amassing information on U.S. citizens is going to help them economically and militarily and with their intelligence. And they think of those three things as basically one and the same.
And okay, so that we have, so we're, it's like we're playing with two different sets of rules then. We have one sense of understanding about what this 2006 agreement was, and they have another one.
Absolutely. And I think that we've seen time and time and again that there is a different way of seeing the world between the United States and China. I mean, forever and ever and ever, people in the United States would say the more technology comes into China, the open internet will come into China, commerce will grow out of it, and it will make China a more free and more open society. Well, that clearly has not happened, despite the fact that the internet is there. There are huge businesses built, huge tech businesses built in China, like Baidu, like Alibaba, and yet we have not seen that liberation and social in that social liberation.
They want to use the data to control people.
Yes, and that's another interesting thing about China. They're very open and they're very straightforward about what they want to do with things like facial recognition, artificial intelligence. And they are, there's a comfort there for them. So they're going to sweep in all of this data on American citizens because ultimately they don't, in China, there's a camera on every corner. They don't have a camera on every corner in the United States, but there are other ways for them to understand Americans and to basically not only surveil us, but to predict what we will do in the future using these enormous big data hacks.
What about, well, first of all, everybody, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Katie Benner. She's a Justice Department reporter for The New York Times, and we're talking about the announcement this week that charges have been filed against four members of China's military on suspicion of hacking into Equifax. That's one of the nation's largest credit reporting agencies, of course, in 2017. This is an indictment that's coming out of the Justice Department. What about Equifax? What kind of responsibility do they share in all of this?
Well, you know, first we should note that the Justice Department in the press conference yesterday, that every official was extraordinarily complimentary of Equifax and how much cooperation that they gave the government as the government tried to figure out what was happening and who had attacked the company. Remember, we did not think that it was a state-sponsored attack at first. Most security researchers thought it was a break-in and that the information about consumers was going to show up on the dark web for sale. But that did not happen, which led people to wonder. And then you saw the government be involved. So they were very complimentary of Equifax. That said, when you read the indictment that was released yesterday, you can see it's clear that a couple of months before the attack, the government warned Equifax that its network contained a vulnerability, but the company did not address it. And then 2 months later, these four members of the Chinese People's Liberation Army were able to exploit the weakness in May of 2017 and break in.
You know, there's so much to talk about here. First of all, how do they nail it to four people? How do they boil it down to that? How does that work?
You know, so this is really interesting. They spoke about this yesterday in the press conference. They had very little information to go on at first. Right? Especially because the military officers, once in Equifax's system, they did a lot to erase their tracks. They were really careful about how they moved within the system so as not to set off any alarms. I'll go through a couple of things they did that the government observed. You know, once they broke in, they stole employee login credentials so they could log in as existing employees, and then they started stealing data. But they masked their activity. They used encrypted communications. They routed their internet traffic through, you know, more than 30 servers in nearly 20 countries, including Switzerland and Singapore. And they were able to also compress files so you wouldn't see these huge reams of data going out, which certainly would set off a security alarm. So those are the things they did. So for the investigators, they were basically working backwards, right? They started reviewing the forensic data that they could find in Equifax's system. They looked at the malware that was used in the attack. And they eventually they say through law enforcement means, we can only assume warrants and other things, perhaps cooperation with other governments, but they kept it as, you know, law enforcement means. We're able to get other data about movements within Equifax's system. And basically, they were able to trace it to China. And then, by establishing a digital footprint that linked them, the attackers to the intrusion, they were able to then narrow it down to these four people. The government has decided not to be more specific than that in their charging documents, because I do not think that they would want the general public to know the sources and methods of how they went from from knowing that it was China to knowing that it was these four people and the sort of technology they used to do that.
You know, given that we're dealing with China, how do they even know these people exist?
Well, I mean, I think that we, again, keep in mind, we're one of many countries with a really sophisticated surveillance and intelligence collecting operation. And so we are aware, just like a country like China would be aware of who is in the military. We've identified military officers just as they've identified our military
just intelligence information. They're real people. Yeah. Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, had harsh words for Equifax. What did he say, and what was the company's response?
You know, I think that Warner, first of all, we should note that Warner was not the only person to be highly critical of Equifax, right? He said, a company in the business of collecting and retaining massive amounts of Americans' sensitive personal information must act with the utmost care and face any consequence that arises from that failure. It was a very harsh statement, and I think it also speaks to the fact that Equifax ignored an explicit warning from the government that they had a massive weakness.
Uh-huh.
I think the decision to ignore the government warning, and what is so frustrating to people like Senator Mark Warner and others, this is very bipartisan. It's not just a Democrat. Republicans and Democrats are really frustrated with this, is that we in the United States, especially around having our information hacked, have become really used to it. You know, your credit card data is stolen often. People have their email accounts compromised, or you'll get a note saying somebody stole all of our data. I think we've had several, Yahoo, Zynga, et cetera, that there's been a data issue. And we just change our passwords and hope for the best, right? So I think that there's a pervasive attitude amongst Americans that there's almost that we've become very immune to feeling too worried about it, because we're like, okay, I guess my credit card number will be sold on the dark web somewhere, but I'm going to cancel that credit card, so it's not a big deal. Nobody will be able to use it. What Warner is trying to say to Equifax and to U.S. citizens is that the kinds of hacks we're going to start seeing are not going to be so that people can make tens of thousands of dollars on the internet selling our personal data. They're going to be national security risks. In response, Equifax basically just said, listen, it is so hard to ward off state-sponsored attacks. You know, we don't think that we can fight every single one. It's going to be a very unsatisfactory answer, but it's also going to force companies, I think, and the government to start working much more closely together, because right now, every company that has a lot of data on Americans, whether it's Equifax or Facebook or anybody who knows a lot about us, is going to become a target for national security-related hacks.
We were just talking about how a community, a suburb of Columbus, has become a hub for data centers. The weather's good, you know, there's lots of access to energy, you know, utilities and that kind of a thing. And how the government, they think, is building another big data center out way out in the country in eastern Ohio, in kind of the middle of nowhere. But are those, I mean, I asked the reporter about security, and he said, well, it seemed pretty secure to him. They don't put names on the buildings or anything like that. But I'm wondering about these data centers. Is that what they're hacking into, or is it just going through employees' email routes?
Well, in the Equifax case, what was interesting is they were basically able to, you know, Equifax, every company has a lot of different ways for a user to interact with the company, right? So whether it's Equifax or whether it's an online store, they have the Equifax has its its site where they're giving out information or where, you know, they're presenting what the company does. But they also have a part of the site where, like, I as a user can lodge a complaint, right,
mm-hmm.
or comment. And it was that part of the site that essentially had the vulnerability where it was like, ooh, it's possible that somebody could kind of worm in and get behind what you and I as a customer see and be kind of in that company's larger online system. That's not a physical data center, right?
Uh-huh.
That's just going in through the company's interface. But I think that, again, anytime a company has a lot of information, the information is very tempting to take for national security reasons, as we've seen. So whether it is a data center or whether it is a company with a lot of consumer data, especially Equifax is really tempting because they have social security numbers.
Yeah, they've got it all.
Addresses.
Plus they can screw your credit rating.
Yeah. They know
ultimate power.
Mortgage is too big for you. You know, imagine you are a person who has taken out too large a mortgage, you're financially struggling, your credit's not very good, you have your social security number, and you're able to lay that over with all of, say, you travel to Marriott or Starwood Hotels, which was also hacked, and they're able to lay that information over and find all of your travels, and they find that in your travels, you're traveling for work a lot. Maybe you're really stressed out, but they're also able to line that up with what you do, and maybe you're going to a lot of conferences. And then they're able to line that up with whether or not you work for a government entity. How interesting would it be then if somebody approached you at the hotel bar of a conference and just happened to have all of your same interests and, oh my goodness, it's so great to meet you because you are doing exactly what I'm doing and just create a really quick bond.
Uh-huh.
This is unfortunately how espionage works. They also know in the back of your head you're desperate for money
uh-huh.
because your mortgage is too big, your credit's terrible, and that's where the grooming process begins, right? And so, and that is somebody who might more easily be convinced to exfiltrate information out of the United States from their government job or their research job or their
okay.
academic job and deliver to the Chinese. Now, that's a national security risk, whether, again, it's data centers, whether it's companies that have personal information, they are just really tempting targets. And I think that Mark Warner is saying that's how we need to think about this. It's no longer an inconvenience. It's a threat.
Has Equifax compensated any of the half of the nation's people that were involved in this?
You know, that's an interesting thing. First of all, you have to wonder what would correct compensation even look like?
Yeah.
At this point, right?
A good credit rating.
So,
everybody gets an A.
But I mean, so Equifax has been sued and they are paying out claims in the couple of tens of thousands of dollars, I think, to some people. But I think that overall, the company has settled the lawsuits related to this hack
mm-hmm.
for about $380 million. That is a lot of money, but you have to imagine this is like half of all Americans getting, you know, a few thousand dollars or tens of thousands of dollars. And that, again, that kind of payment is the kind of payment you make when you've inconvenienced somebody.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but it's hard to figure out what kind of monetary compensation Equifax would need to make to address what the U.S. government is saying the real threat is. That's almost something completely different. And I think that not just Equifax, I felt bad that they're at the heart of this because we're going to keep talking about them, but other companies are right in that position. Marriott was
uh-huh.
in that position. We saw the Office of Personnel Management, our own government, in that
yeah.
position. And so this is going to happen more and more.
Katie Benner, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, it was great to be on.
Katie Benner is a Justice Department reporter for The New York Times. She's been covering the announcement this week that four members of China's military have been indicted on suspicion of hacking into one of the nation's largest credit reporting agencies in 2017. We will continue with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Samsung's Galaxy S new smartphone launches today, and we already have some idea of what to expect. At least Russell Holley does. He's contributing editor at Android Central, longtime contributor to Tech Tuesday. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Before we find out more about the new smartphone, tell us about the 2019 S10 model that made a big splash. That was good, right?
Samsung had a pretty good year last year, releasing a pair of phones that were very similar to the release that Apple had that year, where you've got kind of the small phone and the big phone for people who want either, you know, kind of the smaller, less expensive phone that had a pretty decent battery and a good camera, or if you wanted just kind of the all-out best that it could possibly be phone with a really great camera and a battery that lasted you a while. You had those two options with about a $200 difference in price. And they sold worldwide. They sold very, very well over the last year, and they continue to sell well today, actually.
So why an S20 then?
Yeah. So you would think that the name would actually be 11.
right.
But, the thing there. This is actually kind of a funny numbers game that Apple and Samsung have been playing with one another for a little while now, where they kind of jump the numbers around a little bit to make it look like one is behind the other. And that's kind of a silly version of what you're seeing here. Both companies skipped over the number 9 when trying to release their phones. And so now, instead of seeming like Samsung is a year behind in releasing something with the number 11 on it, they're just skipping ahead to 20. And so we're going to have at least the suspicion is that Samsung's going to announce today not one but 3 phones. With the Galaxy S20 branding. We're expecting, kind of the base model Galaxy S20, a Samsung Galaxy S20 Plus, which is going to be kind of the bigger model that has a nicer battery and maybe some more camera features, and then a much larger phone. The speculation around it is that it's actually going to be close to a 7-inch phone.
Wow.
That is going to be called the Galaxy S20 Ultra. That is going to be considerably more expensive, but also have, just kind of everything that you could possibly want in a phone, a significant jump in camera quality, a much larger battery, and of course, access to 5G networks like the rest of the phone.
So 3 phones with the S20 branding. What's that branding going to be? Just S20?
The S20 is going to be the thing. This is going to be this launch is going to look very similar to the way that Apple just released its iPhones, where you have kind of the iPhone 11, the iPhone 11 Pro, and the iPhone 11 Pro Max. That's essentially what you're looking at here, is Samsung's version of this release, where you've got the standard model that's going to be the one that's on sale most of the time in stores. It's probably going to start around $1,000 if you're buying it off contract, but then it'll be available for monthly agreements that are going to be relatively less expensive, and it'll drop pretty quickly in price because Samsung phones tend to drop by about $200 in price in about 3 months. And then you'll see the Galaxy S20 Plus, which will probably be around $1,200. And then I'm not actually sure what's going to happen with this Galaxy S20 Ultra as far as pricing goes. It could be as much as $1,500 because that is a price that Samsung determined that it was pretty happy with. In the release of the Samsung Galaxy Fold earlier this year. And those are obviously not the same thing. One is a giant screen that folds into a smaller screen, whereas this is just just kind of a larger phone. But it'll be interesting to see what cameras are put on this and why those determinations are made for why it needs to be kind of the more expensive phone.
Battery life is always important, and you said it'll have substantial battery life. How are they getting so much more battery life now in... I know they're bigger phones, but still, is it really just boiled down to the size of the phone?
It really does. It's kind of fascinating. As much as camera technology and processor technology have focused so much on being able to get more out of things that are smaller, battery chemistry is we haven't been able to successfully break science there yet. There's only so many chemicals you can fit into batteries of a specific size, and Samsung has, over the last couple of years, been ultra cautious about its battery technology. Since it got a lot of bad publicity when one of its phones started, catching fire.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
its battery was punctured. So Samsung decided that it was okay with phones being a little thicker, if it meant having a better battery, bigger battery, but still being safe. And so that's what you've seen with the last couple of generations.
And then is it going to be using 5G?
All three of these phones are expected to have 5G radios in them. Whether they are 5G radios that you are using is another matter entirely. You know,
right.
One big thing to keep in mind is that 5G does not work everywhere.
Right.
And that there's not a consensus on whether carriers are going to want to charge more to have access to 5G networks. So while, you know, this phone will certainly give someone access to 5G, it's entirely possible that there will be large groups of people who own these phones and never actually use the 5G radio in them.
So how do you like them? What do you think? What, or just haven't seen it yet? They're going to roll out today.
Yeah, we've seen pictures of them that have kind of been leaked, and this is a weirdly kind of petty thing on my part, but my favorite thing about them is that the camera hole in the front of the phone isn't off to the side anymore. It's in the middle because symmetry is important. Otherwise, I start peeling off pieces of my skin.
Okay.
So it's it looks, you know, visually very, very similar to what you've seen with the Galaxy Note phone that came out last year. That there's not going to be a lot of visual surprises there. We don't know how many colors it's going to come out in, and I know that you know that that's a thing I'm excited about.
It's a very important thing, yes.
It's an extremely important thing. What we do know is that Samsung has not gotten rid of the expandable storage in this. And that actually is kind of a big deal for people who are excited about the camera, because it means that you can still get the expandable storage for when you want to take just a ton of video and a ton of photos. And the way that that technology has increased, you know, if you've got the money to spend, you can put an incredible amount of storage in your phone without having to buy an entirely new phone, which is something that you have to do with most other phones. If you want, you know, kind of the larger model, you have to buy the larger model, whereas this will give you, you know, still the option to expand the storage, you know, which is a big deal for people who take a lot of pictures and record a lot of video.
And when you say expandable storage, you mean it's in the phone itself at the outset?
Right. It's a micro SD card that you can buy and insert in the phone.
Okay.
And in doing so, you have expanded the base storage of the phone.
Mm. Okay, well, we'll wait to see what you think once they come out today. Let's talk about, before we get too far flung from the Oscars, I didn't hear this at the time, but Taika Waititi won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for Jojo Rabbit, which I loved.
It was great.
But did you see it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was fabulous. But in post-ceremony remarks, he shared his disdain for something wholly unrelated, the Apple keyboard. What's his beef?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is actually a pretty common complaint, and it was impressive to see a complaint like this happen on a stage like this. And it took me a minute in watching it. I wasn't sure if he was joking, because you can almost never tell the way that he delivers a lot of things, if he's being serious or not. But he seemed visually frustrated by it when he was talking about it in the press room speech. In writing, Taika Waititi is really just kind of sick of Apple's keyboards. The last couple generations, Apple's keyboards have, in order to make the laptops thinner, they actually have what's called less travel. And what that means is when you press the button down, it doesn't go down as far, it doesn't push back as far as a keyboard you would expect on most computers. And there's actually a special design that Apple made to reduce the amount of space that it takes in order to have a keyboard take up, room on the laptop, which made the laptop smaller, but it also made them a lot less reliable. And a big problem that people have been finding with these over the last couple of years is that any amount of dust or anything like that gets under a keyboard, it actually makes typing way harder, and in some cases renders keys entirely inoperable. And you have to take them. It's not something you can repair yourself. You actually have to take to an Apple store where they have a special tool for lifting up the key and cleaning under it, that they won't actually sell you. They won't sell you the tool to do this.
Huh.
So it's this incredibly frustrating thing that Apple has actually fixed in one version of its laptop. The 16-inch MacBook Pro that was released late last year has an updated keyboard that is supposed to address this problem, but it only affects that one brand new laptop and not the rest of its MacBook line. The rest of its MacBook line hasn't been updated yet. So I wouldn't be surprised if after giving this Oscar speech, someone at Apple was on the phone with Taika Waititi to be like, hey, I have a new laptop for you. Please say nice things about it. Because he was pretty blistering about it. And it is not an original complaint. This is something that for a couple of years now, people have had problems with these keyboards.
Well, how did he come up in the conversation?
So the question he was asked was if there was something he would do to improve the industry.
Okay.
He saw his eyes kind of glaze over for a minute, and he just decided that this was the time to take a shot at Apple.
Oh.
And, you know, as he he's not just a director. He, you know, he writes a lot of the material that he works with.
Right, right. Yeah, he got, this was for screenwriting, yeah.
Right, and so, you know, as a screenwriter, it would not surprise me for him to be frustrated with scenes that would stop working, you know, and he said, you know, on multiple occasions there, it was enough to make him want to go back to a PC because, you know, because the keyboards were, at the very least, you know, consistent there. So it would be really interesting to be a fly on the wall in the conversation that somewhat at Apple's PR had with, you know, someone representing Taika immediately following that, because I'm sure that conversation happened.
Let's see. Amazon has pulled out of the Mobile World Congress, which takes place later this month in Barcelona, and it's over the coronavirus-related concerns. I'm kind of surprised about that. What is a Mobile World Congress?
So Mobile World Congress is a smartphone-focused event that happens every year in Barcelona, and it is the entire world, you know, showing off things that are going to be released later this year, talking about the network infrastructure that's going to impact the world. This is where the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas at the beginning of every year tends to have a more United States focus, or at the very least a North America focus.
Uh-huh.
Mobile World Congress is, you know, kind of the smartphone version of that for the entire world. So new phones that are released in India, new phones that are released in Barcelona, or you know, or in other places around the world, are often announced at this event. And so, you know, this is a huge place for industry, you know, people to get together and have meetings, or to kind of plan out next steps, or to make big announcements for phones that are maybe not coming to the United States. Actually, Amazon is one of many companies that have announced that they are not coming to Mobile World Congress this year because of the concerns over the coronavirus. And this is after the organizers for Mobile World Congress have specifically banned anyone who registered to attend the event that was from, you know, some of the impacted parts of China.
Yeah.
But it just, you know, it wasn't enough. And a lot of these organizers are actually pulling out, you know, here just a couple weeks beforehand. And it's no surprise why, you know, to put, you know, a lot of these press events are 500 and 600 people pretty closely, you know, together in a room. In a room that is often not particularly well ventilated, and you know, the refreshments that are offered afterwards are often, you know, kind of shared plates and things like that. It's you know, it is, under the best of circumstances, a pretty great way to get yourself sick if someone walks into the room infected with, you know, just a common cold.
Yeah, but what's this going to do to the World Congress? I mean, it sounds like it's going to fall flat.
There are a pretty significant number of companies that have already said that they're either not going to be there, or they're not going to hold these big events while they are there, and will instead just do smaller meetings.
Uh-huh.
There have been reports of conversations about whether the organizing body for this event will actually just cancel it altogether. I find that unlikely, just given how much money goes into this event every year. But it will certainly not look the same as it has looked in past years by current indications. And it'll be really interesting to see, as the rest of this week plays out, how many more organizations decide that they're not going to be there.
I mean, I guess I'm wondering, because it's going to be in Barcelona. It's not like it's in Hong Kong.
Sure, but there are a lot of Chinese entities that show up for this event.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, a ton of companies that represent, you know, Chinese companies. Or travel really, you know, frequently in and out of China. Like, this is a pretty significant place for Chinese companies to show up and announce the things that are going to be released from those organizations every year. So it is not happening in these areas, but a lot of the people from these areas are going to be represented there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is causing what I would consider unnecessary panic. You know, just because someone is Chinese or from China, China's a pretty big place.
Right.
You know, so that does not immediately mean that that they're going to be infected or a carrier for something like this, but it is a concern that they are dealing with.
Russell Holley, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor, Android Central. He's with us almost every single Tuesday for Tech Tuesday. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.